Welcome to Failing Up, a podcast where we explore failure.
Why we're afraid of it, why we try to avoid it, and the success that can arise directly from it.
Failure comes in many shapes and forms. It can even mean different things to different people.
This show, Failing Up, intends to explore all aspects. These are the stories of people who have experienced profound failures that ultimately led them to something positive.
We hope this helps us all learn and grow. Thanks for listening.
My name is Eden.
And I'm Guy.
Yes, we really appreciate you taking the time and being on the show with us today, Ray. So you probably know already, but this show deals with failure. That's the big topic. People who have experienced profound failures and turned it around into something great. I don't know if your story is if you look at what happened as a failure, but obviously we want to talk to you about everything that happened, starting with the beginning of your life. You were born and raised in the Bronx, is that right?
Yeah, I was born in the Bronx.
And you were a teenager during the late 60s, early 70s? Is that accurate?
I was a teenager in the 70s, and 1973 is when the journey started.
What was it like before 1973? What's it like growing up in the Bronx? Is it a rough place to grow up?
I lived in the Bronx and in Brooklyn, and it was really, really rough, and it was really, really great.
Really great in the sense that you learned lessons, or
it was. Because it was fun, it was exciting, there was nothing boring about being in the Bronx and in Brooklyn, you know? I mean, it was the aspect of my life was about hanging around and initially I didn't know anything but the aspect of the gangs in the area and then later on I would discover that there was more to it than that.
Yeah. What kind of student were you?
I was a shitty student up until I discovered baseball. And then when I found out that if I didn't have passing grades, I couldn't play, I became a decent student.
At a young age, you saw your future being in baseball?
When I discovered the Yankees, you know what I'm saying? You know my story.
I do. We can jump right into it. Was it 1973 when you actually discovered the Yankees?
Right. Well, you know, I discovered the Yankees when I discovered Mickey Mantle. And my father sent me to my first Yankee game and to see Mickey Mantle, your hero, hit two home runs that day. You know, it was like a phenomenon, you know, something that would stay with you. But that was it. I was just a fan.
You weren't playing at that time, were you?
Hey, when I discovered Mickey Mantle, all of a sudden I started playing, you know, and then after that it was I became pretty decent, but I was still out in the streets up until the point of getting caught doing the graffiti outside Yankee Stadium.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. So the story goes, it's the last day of your junior year of high school, is that right?
Right.
And you skipped school.
Right.
And I assume you didn't do that alone.
Well, that day I did it alone. I went to what happened was I went to the Bronx to hang out with my brothers and some people over there. And next thing you know, we were out doing, you know, what we always did. What we were playing, you know, handball and stuff like that. And then we went out to do some graffiti. And it just happened that our plan was to do one of the walls over there and then sneak into the game that night.
Okay, so you were going to you had a plan to put the Yankee logo on the outside of Yankee Stadium and then sneak into the game.
Right.
And I remember back then, I don't know if they still do this, I feel like around the seventh inning, they would open up the stand, like the game for free anyway.
No? They don't do that now, naturally. They don't have to. But in those days, in the sixth inning, they would let people in.
Yeah. And so you're the one who gets picked to actually do this spray painting.
I was caught doing graffiti outside the stadium. A car came on the sidewalk. Two guys jumped out. I'm the one that was caught. I was put into a holding cell at the old Yankee Stadium. They used to have a precinct right downstairs in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
And so they put me in the holding cell in there. And then within the probably 20 minutes, the guy that had caught me came back and said, "Give me the kid." And next thing you know, he had dragged me to the Yankee locker room. I didn't know where we were going initially.
Yeah.
Until we got to the door and it said, you know, no admittance, players only. And he knocked on the door And the old man that was the clubhouse manager, Pete Sheehy, came and opened the door. And next thing you know, Steinbrenner was saying to Pete, give him a uniform. He's got damages. He's going to work off. The guy was George Steinbrenner, who at the time I really didn't know because he had just brought the team that year.
Oh, wow. Okay, so you didn't, when he caught you, he said something like, kid, don't you know who I am, right?
Initially.
Yeah.
At some point he said that, but, you know, I mean, I didn't know who he was. I had no idea who he was.
And when you're sitting in a holding cell in Yankee Stadium, Ray, what are the thoughts? Are you crapping your pants? Are you like, my parents are going to kill me? What's going through your mind?
That I had never been arrested and that what was going to happen to me. And, you know, I was hoping to be able to say to somebody to give me another shot. Because when they were first initially putting me in there, took me down there, I had said to the guys, could he cut me a break? And initially he had said that I didn't deserve a break for doing something like that, you know? And the guy that was with him just kept on saying, he's a piece of shit anyway. I mean, I don't know if I can curse on this.
Sure.
Thing, but,
feel free.
You know, but the guy just kept on saying, he's a piece of shit. He's like all these other kids in the neighborhood. He's scum. He's no good, blah, blah, blah. You know, I mean, he didn't even know me.
Yeah.
But that's all he kept on saying. And I think that he said it enough times that it just aggravated Steinbrenner to the point where he finally, they kept on arguing, and Steinbrenner kept on telling him, I'm the owner here. I own the team. This is my fucking team. You know, why don't you shut the fuck up? I own this team, you know, and that's the guy probably did me a favor by going at it that way so that he irritated Steinbrenner so much that Steinbrenner wanted to show, you know, he wanted to show this guy
who's boss
that he could, that he could do something. Like he said, you can't change these kids. You can't. They're all garbage. There's nothing you can do with them. And that just, you know, that was like a challenge, you know what I'm saying? And that challenge, hey, I'm grateful. I'm more grateful to that piece of shit than I am to Steinbrenner, because you know what? He's the one that got him going. And you know what? It was a challenge that Steinbrenner kept on his mind, not only for me, but for so many others like me. Because after that, he wanted to help any kid that they said was a bad boy. He just, it was like, you know what? He became Father Flanagan to the poor. Yep. You know what I'm saying? Yep. Like myself. He became like, you know, I don't know if you ever saw the movie A Boy's Town.
I have.
You ever see that movie with, it was with Pat O'Brien and Mickey Rooney?
I did not.
And in that movie, they kept on saying, you know, these are bad kids. And Steinbrenner. And Father Flanagan would always say, there's no such thing as a bad boy. You know what I'm saying? And it was always a constant reminder to me whenever I saw him trying to help a new kid. Whenever there was a new rain that grown in his midst that he could try to help, it was just like, it was like unreal, and it was hilarious, and it was fun.
So you were the first in the line of many, and really the interesting thing about George, well, many interesting things about George Steinbrenner, but what you point out right there is, you know, I grew up in New Jersey, 70s, 80s, 90s, and I actually started becoming a Yankee fan because of one of your friends, Reggie Jackson. That's the only person I knew. I knew Reggie Jackson. I didn't know he was a Yankee. He probably wasn't a Yankee when I first got on my radar. But regardless, there was a point to my Reggie Jackson parallel here, and I'm slipping on it. So I'm just going to move on. So you're in this holding cell. George Steinbrenner says to you, okay, come with me. You end up in the locker room, and now they put you to work. How?
Hey, but he didn't even say come with me. He just like grabbed me and just next thing you know, he was like pulling on me up until we got into the locker room. And then when we got into the locker room, he told the equipment manager, give him a uniform. He's got damages. He's going to work off.
Okay, I remembered what I was going to say. So George Steinbrenner, growing up when I grew up, he was known as a bad guy. He was not known as a good guy. And what I found out, not just from your story, but from so many other people, like I know people now that have personal stories, he was probably the most low-key, really good guy that existed, right? Like one of the more low-key good guys. He did a bunch of good stuff for people nobody ever knew about.
Well, did you ever hear Elvis Presley say that his line was, the man is one thing and the image is another.
Yeah.
Okay? And George has never wanted for people to know that he could be benevolent.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Initially, like a classic example of that. One time he was getting on an airplane. He was in first class. This is before private jets. He's in first class, and a lady walks on with a shopping bag going to the back of the plane. And Steinbrenner says to her, "Do me a favor, take my seat. I want to sit in the back." You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so he gave her his first class seat, and he went to the back of the plane. And when he got off the plane, Dwight Gooden was on that flight, and he saw what happened, but he was in first class. And he went up to him. He said, "Mr. Steinbrenner, I'm Dwight Gooden." "Oh, hi, Dwight. How are you?" And then Dwight says, "I saw what you did with that lady. I thought that was really nice." And Steinbrenner said, "You saw shit." And he walked away.
Wow. Wow. I'm not surprised. I had a friend who told me he wrote George Steinbrenner, you know, this is probably 20 years ago now, wrote him and said, "Hey, my dad grew up a Yankee fan. He never got to see a game. If there's anything you could do to, like, just, you know, nosebleed seats, whatever, please." So he doesn't expect much of it. 3 days later, 4 days later, he gets a phone call. It's George Steinbrenner. Not only did he give him seats, he gave the whole family front row seats to the game and just said, "Hey, enjoy your day." And that's the kind of thing that, like, I get kind of chills from it, because, again, like, anybody who grew up in New York, New Jersey, Eden, in that time,
yeah,
he was an evil guy. Was like, everybody just hated him. Like, he made all the, you know, in everybody's mind, he made all the wrong decisions, like, for the team. He was just buying players that didn't work out and, you know, this and that. And so he was not loved universally,
so
especially in the 80s, I would say. Towards the end, there was more love. They saw who the man truly was. But if you told 8-year-old me that I would think that George Steinbrenner was a really good dude one day, I would never have believed you.
Hmm.
Well, you know what happened with George, why he became so beloved, is because he had helped just too many people. Hmm. You understand?
Yeah.
It was the number was so overwhelming that there wasn't enough people who hated him. That's the problem. You know, and that would upset the hell out of him. And let me tell you this, like the last 5 years of his life, I started, like, just, you know, like, I just said, "Fuck this shit. I'm going to let everybody know what this guy's been doing." And there wasn't a newspaper that I wouldn't tell him all the great shit that he did. I leaked so many stories, and so he said, "It has to be you. You're the one that's giving out those stories. I know it's you." And I said, "Okay, it's me. Now what? You're going to fire me?" and he said, "Why are you doing this?" And he said, "Boss, do you understand that we live in a copycat society? And if Donald Trump and all of these other fucking assholes see what you're doing, they're going to do the same thing." And they do.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And that's what I'm telling you. And that's what happened. Hey, Trump told me on so many occasions how in essence, he learned from George, not the bad shit, but a lot of the good stuff, of which Trump does all the time, because Trump does a lot of stuff and doesn't tell anybody.
That's interesting. And so you're calling the Daily News, you're calling the Post, or you had somebody inside there that you'd be like, "Hey, it's Ray. I want to tell you this story." Was it that easy?
It was that, of course.
That's amazing.
I think they were hungry for stories.
So now let's talk about you. You're pulled into the clubhouse. He says, "Give you a uniform," which is crazy. I mean, a Yankee uniform. That, to me, that's like sacred.
I mean, how old are you?
I'm 42.
Oh, so you're young. See, they gave me a uniform that belonged to a guy by the name of Jerry Kennett, and he used to wear number 2. And so you could still see the outline of the 2 on the uniform, you know. But it was the smallest uniform that they had. You understand? So that's why they gave me that particular uniform.
Did you get a number though, right?
No, it was blank. They took the number off, but you could see the outline of the number.
That's amazing. And what do they have you do? Like, do they have you immediately start working in the clubhouse?
Initially, I just basically followed the other kids around. They showed me what to do, what they did, how they cleaned the helmets, how they cleaned the shoes, you know. And then we went out to the field, and then the third base coach, a guy by the name of Dick Hauser, he was in charge of the bat boys. And so then he asked me, first thing he asked me was, did I know how to play baseball? So I told him, yeah. So then he told me, okay, go to the outfield and shag. And that was my first day, you know. And then I was the ball boy down the right field line. And then after the game was over, Steinbrenner was there to greet me. He had already spoken to my parents. You know, my parents had to come and and pick me up. Yeah, so so they came, and he met with them. And then the four of us got together, and he asked me, did I have a great day? How was your day, is what he asked. How was your day? And I said, greatest day of my life. Wow. I said, he said, you want to keep this job? And I said, I would love to keep this job. And so then he went into his pocket. I think he gave me a $50 bill or a $20 bill. I don't remember, because it was usually like a $50 bill. But that day he gave me $20 is what it was for the car fare. And that's how he paid me that season. 73, because I was only, you know, I wasn't there the whole year. I started in June, so it was only like, I only was in and out for like 2 months, and then I started full-time as a bat boy in 74 when we went to Shea Stadium. And so, anyway, so in 73, because the season had already started and all that kind of stuff, he just paid me out of his pocket. Hey, which was better than getting the regular team paid. Because, I mean, do the math. $50 today, how much is that? That's a lot of money, right?
Heck yeah, that's great money.
And if they gave it to you in cash, you don't have to write it off in your taxes.
He just pulled out a $50 bill. Here you go.
That's ideal.
Right, okay, you got money? I'm okay. No, well, here, take this. That's how it always was.
It's a good gig.
So he called your mom, and is it your stepfather?
Right.
And then when they come in, are they mad at you? I mean, they have to know you skipped school that day, no?
My mother was mad at me. She was, my mother. Hey, you ever see the movie The Pride of the Yankee?
Yes.
My parents were just like his parents, Lou Gehrig's parents. My mother was the matriarch. She was the tough one. She's the one that gave the beatings. You know, and my father was just, they were both little. Just like Garrett's family, little people. My father never said anything, man. He was just, a very nice, shy man. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Who all he did was work for his family his whole life. That's all he did was work for us. And so basically, he got him there. He told him what happened. He told him what he would like. He told him that he wanted to give me a job, be with the team. And, he asked my mother, do you think he's okay coming to the Bronx on the train? And my mother said, he's always sneaking to the Bronx anyway. So at least I know where he'll be now instead of with his crazy brothers. Because, my brothers were from my father, you see. And so they lived in the Bronx, and I was living in Brooklyn. I just wanted to hang out with them.
Gotcha. But as far as, like, for you, was the Bronx a scary place? Or was just just life?
No, not for me.
Yeah.
No, because I was used to that. Brooklyn was as tough as the Bronx, and we had more gangs where we were than they did in the Bronx, especially in the South Bronx at that time. But I mean, the Bronx was burning, but it wasn't like, there were more murders in Brooklyn than there were in the Bronx.
I just remember being a little kid and going to Yankee Stadium, and that place, that just the Bronx in general, was a scary place to me. And maybe it's because I'm a white Jewish kid.
Well, then that's why.
That's probably why.
You did a variety of jobs in the clubhouse. You were their clubhouse assistant. You were a bat boy. You were Reggie Jackson's gopher.
I worked for Reggie. I became his right hand man. I answered all his fan mail.
Wow.
And I got his cars washed, and I took care of his apartment. But I also, anything that I would do for Reggie Jackson, I did for Thurman Munson or any of the other guys. You know, you understand?
Yeah.
Because I didn't want, you know, I was smart enough. That's the one thing that Steinbrenner knew about me, that I had a tremendous amount of common sense. And I didn't want to be loved by, you know, I didn't want to be loved by one player. I wanted to be loved by the team.
Yeah.
You understand?
Yeah.
The team sport.
And I was craving love. Okay, that was like the big thing for me. And the fact that my real father abandoned me, I couldn't have enough big brothers and role models and fathers. I just praised it, man. Like Billy Martin was truly a, you know, I idolized him. I loved him, you know, just like Steinbrenner. If you ever saw the movie A Bronx Tale,
yep.
I mean, Sonny is a combination of George and Billy Martin. He was the two of them wrapped into one, you know, and no matter, hey, you know what, George Steinbrenner could scream at me all he wants. I knew that he loved me. You understand?
Yeah.
And so I didn't fear him. Okay. I respected him. I didn't fear him. Billy Martin. Everybody feared Billy. I didn't fear Billy. I loved Billy. And I knew that we had a great mutual respect. And if Billy told me to go and shoot somebody, you know what? I probably would have done it, because that's how strong that fucking love was.
Wow.
Then I would do anything. And, you know, thank God he never asked me to do anything sinister.
So did you consider Billy Martin more of a friend? Like, was he a friend or was he more of a father figure to you? Or both?
Billy Martin was, at that particular time, was a true father to me. People didn't know or understand how close we were. They had no clue how close we were.
Yeah.
And a lot of, you know, hey, when he got fired, I would be at the house with him. Okay? And
really?
We would be crying together.
After the third time he gets fired, though, are you like, "Ah, George is going to have you back at some point"?
Yeah, because George loved him.
Yeah.
There was an incredible love between those two guys. Like, you know what, Billy could say, "Fuck George, that piece of shit." But if he heard someone say that about George, he'd punch him right in the face.
That's insane. But so the people you were the closest with were, I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, Billy Martin, Thurman Munson, Reggie Jackson.
Or, right.
I mean, I know you were friendly with the other guys, but were those your top three, or does like a Chris Chambliss make that list?
No, he doesn't make that list like that. I had a like, if you have five brothers, you know who your soul brothers are.
Yep.
You understand?
Yeah.
And that's just the way it is. And for me, the boss, Billy, Thurman, and Reggie were my guys. And I have to add in that list Bobby Mercer.
Oh, really?
Bobby Mercer, Bobby Mercer was like, I mean, right there. I mean, I would never say this one over that one. Okay, those were my guys right there. I loved them. I would do anything for them. To this day, me and their families are still very, very close. You know, we still cry together.
Yeah,
we still cry together.
So let's go back a little bit to, because there's some other interesting things that you did for the Yankees. So I know you said you were helpful to everybody. So you used to babysit for Bobby Bonds, for his son Barry.
Right.
You were Barry Bonds' babysitter.
Initially what had happened was, I was trying to remember who was the first one. I mean, I was the guy that the players would leave their kids with all the time. You know what I'm saying? Because, you know, I was a kid. I'm still a kid. So, you know, we would always be playing in the hall, you know, all sorts of games with the balls and all that, throwing it around or going out on the field when the games were open, the dads were getting changed and all that. And I'd have all the kids out on the field. I was like truly like the Pied Piper. And then when we got Bobby Bonds, we had Bobby Bonds and we had Sandy Alomar. And so they lived in the same building in Riverside Drive. And then every Saturday, the families, the Bonds and the Alomars, would go eat together. It would be like the family, the date.
Yeah.
The husband and the wives would go on a date, and I would babysit the kids.
So Sandy Alomar Jr.?
I would have Robbie Alomar and Sandy Alomar Jr. and Bobby Bonds Jr. and Barry Bonds.
That's amazing. Some of the greatest players ever.
Hey, and the funny thing about it was that Bobby Bonds had a ping pong table in the living room, right? You know, people have, you know, generally don't have ping pong tables in their living room.
Yeah.
And so when they would leave, the Bonds boys and the Alomars would play against each other. And what was incredible was to watch Barry Bonds playing against Robbie Alomar. It was like watching the Chinese competition.
Really?
I mean, that's how incredible they were. They were the only people I've ever seen play like that were the Chinese.
Huh. You're saying they're just naturally gifted.
Or naturally Chinese.
Incredible. Just the most incredible hand-eye coordination I've ever seen.
Wow. That's insane. And then at some point, you actually were the team's batting practice pitcher?
Well, what happened was, let me add that I used to have to babysit Hal Steinbrenner, who would end up being the king of the Yankees.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I was the only one at that time that Steinbrenner trusted with his son.
That's insane.
He would have me come to spring training, and my reporting date was based upon when his son actually was going to be in Fort Lauderdale.
And were you treated like when you do that kind of stuff? How are you on the team planes, or are you driving to Florida, for example?
No, at that time I would fly down. I would fly to Florida.
Okay, but with the team?
Commercial
plane. Okay.
No, everybody got to Florida on their own.
Oh, really?
Yeah. This is the 70s, man.
Yeah, I know. I'm too young, I guess, to realize how it was different back then.
Totally different. And we're talking about only one bus when we were traveling, like going to the airport. Like now they have like three buses and all that kind of thing. One bus.
Yeah. Probably without a bathroom or air conditioning.
We can open the windows in those days.
Yes, a long
time.
You
can't open the window on the buses anymore.
You cannot. So let's talk about you as a batting practice pitcher. How long did you last as a BP pitcher?
What happened was that in 1975, I became such a good player that I ended up getting drafted in the second round by the Pittsburgh Pirates. And when I proved to America that I was a horseshit hitter, I got released and I went back to the Yankees in 76. And I was so embarrassed because the fanfare was like, you know, oh, second round Yankee bat boy. He's gonna be the next Gene Michael. That's how I left, you know. And Steinbrenner was all upset because Pittsburgh drafted me because Pat Gillick, his scout, said we don't have to draft Ray until about eighth or ninth round.
Oh, you know, wow.
That's what Gillick, you see. And so somebody fucked up there because I ended up getting drafted in the second round. And so Steinbrenner was like, who the hell? I should fire all of you. You know, it was like crazy. I mean, to this day, I still joke about it with Pat Gillick whenever I see him, you know. And Gillick to this day says, yeah, that's why I'm going into the Hall of Fame as a scout. You know what I'm saying?
Now, did you only have like a couple of official at-bats, though?
I'm embarrassed to say, I think I hit 124.
You got drafted by the Pirates. There's nothing to be embarrassed about. You could hit zero and not be embarrassed about that.
Hey, listen, I'm just happy I got a hit.
Do you remember the hit?
I sure do. It was a line drive to right field.
That must be an amazing feeling. But so when you come back to New York, do you feel like your tail is between your legs a little bit?
I was embarrassed. I hid in my house, and then somebody told, oh, you know, Walt No Neck Williams. You ever hear that name?
I have not, no.
Walt No Neck Williams was a utility outfielder on the Yankees. And he told Billy Martin that I had gotten released. And, and then Billy called me and said, what the fuck are you doing? Mm-hmm. And, I had nothing to say. And so then he said, listen, get your fucking ass here tomorrow. We'll find something for you to do. I'll talk to George. He doesn't even know that you got released. get your ass over here.
When you
and so then he went and he told George, and so when I got over there, he told me, you know, start off throwing batting practice. Hopefully, you can get the ball over the plate. And this is 76, and the Yankees were like, just all of a sudden, they were becoming the Yankees. You understand?
Right.
Not the 74 Yankees. These son of a bitches will be, this was a great, great team, and the intimidation just got to me, you know? I hit Willie Randolph one day, and then I hit a catcher by the name of Rick Dempsey, and he threw a bat at me.
Oh, my God.
Okay, so then when I was like taking after you, in those days after you threw batting practice, when you were done, you would take the throws at first base from the shortstop and second base when they were hitting ground balls, and as I was taking the throws, I could hear Dempsey screaming at Billy Martin as Billy was walking on the field. He started screaming at him, saying, "Get that motherfucker out of here! He can't throw a fucking strike." He's fucking us all up. And I'm dying. I am dying listening to this. And so then the next day when I walked into the clubhouse, I'm putting on the uniform. The equipment manager says, "Don't put your uniform on. Go see Billy in his office."
Oh, no.
Oh my God, I'm dying. And when I walk into the office, he's sitting there with Steinbrenner. And then when I walk in, Steinbrenner says, "Well, you fucked up again." And I go, "Oh my God." And so then I turned around to start walking out. I just wanted to leave. You understand?
Yeah.
And so as I walked around, started walking out, Steinbrenner screamed, "Get your ass back over here!" And Billy said, "Get over here!" And so when I walk in, they say, "You see these boxes over there?" And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "Well, open them up. There's some video equipment in there." And Steinbrenner says, "Listen, when I worked in football, we used to do videos. So I want you to learn how to use this machine." He said, I got the easiest one possible. Learn how to use the son of a bitch. And once you do, start taking film of the guys hitting. And the hitting coach will tell you how, you know, what shots he wants and all that. That's how we're going to use you. And that was phase two or three or four, whichever phase of my life that was.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. When you got cut by the Pirates, was it a failure feeling?
Oh, my God. There's no question. Because I went there with the thought that I would someday get to the major league. My plan was I would spend a couple of years in the minor leagues, and then I would end up getting drafted in the minor league draft to go to be back to the Yankees.
That was the dream. And then when you got cut, what's the thought? What are you going to do?
I didn't know what I was going to do. I had no idea what I was going to do. I sat in my house for 2 weeks, literally, like, crying and embarrassed, and I just didn't know what the hell. I didn't want anybody to see me. Anybody.
And Billy was the first. Billy Martin was the first one that reached out to you.
And he reached out to me, yeah.
Wow. That is amazing. And so, at what point do you become George Steinbrenner's special assistant?
That wouldn't have, well, you know, I was always his special assistant, and I'm going to tell you why. When we got Reggie, and Reggie started fighting with the guys in the clubhouse and, you know, stuff like that. And when he saw whenever Reggie saw me, he would always start talking to me in Spanish. You understand? Because he didn't want anybody to know what he was talking about.
Right.
And so, you know, one thing just led to another, and, you know, he just felt a comfort zone with me. And Steinbrenner noticed that, and so, like, one day, like, Steinbrenner and Billy actually talked about that. And then one day Billy came to me and he said, "You and the big guy are getting along well, huh?" So I didn't know if he was being sarcastic or what. So I said, "Billy, you mad with me?" And he said, "Hell no." He said, I want you to stay as close to him as possible, because if that's how I'm going to get the best production out of him, then do it. So stay close to him. I said, "You're helping me big time, and make sure to talk to Mr. Steinbrenner about it." And so then I went to see him. I said, "Boss, you wanted to see me?" And he said, "Yeah, I like that you and Reggie are close. I like that. Do that. I want him to be comfortable. And you know what? He hates Billy. That's not going to change. So, I mean, you stay, what do you call it? Don't let them know that you and Billy are close. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But, you know, naturally he would find out how close me and Billy were. But at the same time, I always, you know, I never, I'm the type of person that if you're my friend, I'm going to let you know that I appreciate your friendship, because friendship for me was, like, so important.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And I never used the word lightly. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because of the aspect of how Billy, the way Billy and the boys treated me, you know, I mean, I had this extreme loyalty that, again, like I said to you, if they asked me anything, I would do anything for them. You know, that's how much I loved them. And it was a very, very deep love for both of them. Hey, listen, Billy was the type of guy that if he was meeting up with Sinatra, sometimes he would say, Rick, let's go have dinner, and not even tell me that we're having dinner with Frank Sinatra.
That's insane. And, you know, Billy Martin's another guy that is looked at, I mean, mainly as, like, just a hard ass, right? They don't know its softer side. People don't know it.
Hey, Billy, you see, that was the attraction. For me, that attracted me to Billy, because he was a gangster.
Yeah.
You understand?
Yeah.
He was a gangster. He wasn't afraid of anybody. He didn't give a shit how big, how small. I mean, he was such a tough guy that, in essence, it made me tougher. I mean, to the point where in 1976, I actually fought in the Golden Gloves just to prove to Billy that I could be tough, too.
Wow. Yeah, he was a brawler. I've read stories. I read this book called, I don't know if you know it, Damned Yankees. It was probably in the 80s. That it was put out, and it just talks about the craziness that was going on within that clubhouse, and it seems like a fun time to be a part of the team, frankly.
Hey, like they said in the movie Goodfellas, it was a glorious time. Okay,
was that the best time of your life? I mean, as far as baseball and the Yankees go,
not even close. Wait. Hey, those Yankees were gangsters, man. You know,
yeah.
You know, they were, dude, it was a party. And you know what? As much as we fought with each other, that's how much those guys loved each other.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And how they loved Thurman Munson. Oh, my God, how they loved Thurman Munson.
I definitely want to talk about Thurman, too. I know, you know, you were close, and I've read a lot about your relationship with him and stuff. Before we do that, I have another big story that you're a part of. 1977 World Series. You're the bat boy for the team. You're in the dugout for the World Series and part of one of the most amazing and famous feats in sports history and the aftermath, right? You're in the dugout for Reggie Jackson hitting 3 home runs in a row in the 77 World Series, Game 6.
Right.
And there's a story around that, and I don't want to ruin it, but I'll give it this part. You had a hand in inventing something.
The curtain call.
Yes. Can you tell that story?
Well, what had happened was that had been such a difficult year. Poor Reggie was so stressed out because, I mean, he asked the boss to trade him several times. You know, he just didn't feel welcome. He didn't feel like the fans dug him. You know, he felt that the fans sided with Billy over him, you know, all that kind of shit, you know, and it was very difficult, you know, and so it got to the point that I always used to say, Reggie used to say, Ray, I'm gonna get traded, and he knew how much I appreciated his abilities as a Major League Baseball player. He knew that. Anybody that played in the Major Leagues, I appreciate, because I knew how hard it was, and then for him to be one of the all-time greats, forget about it. And, you know, and so I appreciated that about him. But, you know, like that season, like he literally would break out in his face because of the stress. I never realized what stress can do until I saw Reggie Jackson that season. And what I appreciated so much about Reggie, that even with all of that stress, he could still concentrate for those 15 seconds that an at-bat would take to be able to do his damage. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Incredible. So when we got to the World Series, by September, him and Thurman had become very good friends. very good friends. If you ever saw the interview with Bob Costas, the last interview that Reggie did with Bob Costas, in it, Bob Costas says to Reggie, "Reggie, do you regret the fact that you and Thurman Munson weren't friends?" And Reggie says, "Well, you have that wrong, because there was a guy, there's a guy that's still with the Yankees to this day by the name of Ray Negron, who actually put us together. He actually had us have a dinner together, and we worked out all our differences, and they were very, very good friends." Okay, well, that's what people do not understand. And you know what? One of the most proud things that I accomplished in baseball was the fact that I was able to put those two guys together. And I unequivocally will say I did that, and I'm proud of it. And I'll scream it on top of the Empire State Building, okay? Because I love Thurman so much, what he meant. He was the heart and soul of that team. And so anyway, by the time we got to the World Series, he was okay with Billy, but he was great with Thurman. And Thurman was his biggest fan in that clubhouse. And when he hit the first home run, I went up to Reggie and I said, "Reggie, why don't you take a curtain call?" "Hell no." And I said, "Come on, Reggie, now this is the World Series. Fuck that." So then he hit a second home run. And I go up to him, "Reggie, that's two. Do it now." "No, I'm not doing it." So I said, "When you hit the third home run, you're going to do it then, right?" And he laughed and he said, "You know, you're crazy, but I'll do it." And what happens? He hits the third home run on the first pitch. And when he rounded the bases, he came in, he's sitting down, and you can see it on the video. When you watch the video, it's clear as day. And you see me go to his ear, and I say, "Reggie, you promised. Take the curtain call. You promised." And he looks at me, and then he runs out and takes his curtain call. And then after that, if he hit a foul ball, he took a curtain call.
was that the first known curtain call in baseball?
You know what? It was the first. It was the first one from the standpoint of truly being acknowledged.
Yeah.
Because after that, all guys did it. Like, you know what? One of the first curtain calls was when Roger Maris hit his 61st home run, and they had to literally pull him out of the dugout, and he only went to the top step, waved, started coming in, and the guys kept pushing him out.
You know, that makes me think about something. What for you has been the great, like, as far as game wise, what's the greatest game you've ever witnessed?
You know what? For me, it's a tie between the Chambliss game and the three home run game.
I was actually, not to throw myself into this too much, but I was at David Cone's perfect game myself.
Well, you know, for me, it was the fact that it was George Steinbrenner's first championship. You know, that 76, you know, and I know what that meant for him. You know, because you know what Steinbrenner did? He showed up to the ballpark wearing his nice, expensive suit, but he brought a cheap suit so that he could wear it for the celebration. You know, and so I mean, I really wanted him to. I really wanted him to get that. You know, I just wanted him to get that. I know what it meant, and he's never enjoyed a world. A championship celebration more than when Chambliss hit that home run. God, he literally came into the clubhouse and he dragged Cary Grant with him. He made Cary Grant come into the clubhouse with him. And Cary Grant, who was one of the coolest cats ever, but you know what? He got killed with champagne, man. It was unbelievable.
Oh my God.
That must have been just unbelievable.
They had social media back then.
Oh yeah. Yeah, exactly. Social media, that would have been all over.
Hey, and you know what Cary Grant's classic line was, right?
What is his classic line?
"Judy, Judy, Judy." Okay, whenever a guy is imitating Cary Grant, that's the line they use. You know, it was a very famous line. And so when he came into the clubhouse and they started killing him with the champagne, the whole team started screaming, Jody, Jody, Jody. It was hilarious.
I wonder if he liked that or if that was just annoying to him.
Let me tell you, he was like a little kid.
Man. Oh, really?
He was like a little, unbelievable. He lost his cool.
Let's talk about Thurman Munson for a little bit. For those of you who don't know, who are not Yankee fans or baseball fans, but Thurman Munson was a great catcher for the Yankees, and he ended up passing away. He flew his own plane. He was going to visit his family, as he often did in Ohio, and he crashed the plane, and he passed away in the middle of the season in August. Let me ask you that. I mean, I read, and everybody should read, you wrote an article called 5 Days in August about your experiences with Thurman.
Yeah.
And one of the greatest parts of the article that I really appreciate, and I mean, it's a big part of the article, which is you didn't just talk about how Raina Grohm feels today about Thurman Munson. You found or you had your archives of, you'd written that day and that week about what happened with Thurman. And you actually, that's part of the article is like, I'm going to guess a number, 18-year-old Raina Grohm's, or maybe a little bit older, Raina Grohm's impressions of what happened as it happened.
Well, the reason I did that was because I started to hyperventilate. It was, it's still hard. And, it was the first time that I witnessed death of someone I loved. And so when I would leave the stadium, I couldn't breathe. I was choking, and I ended up going to an emergency room and this and that, and they didn't, they just didn't see what the fuck was going on with me, except when they found out about the situation, who I was and all that, they sent a therapist to see me, a psychologist that was there, a psychiatrist that had been right there. And the guy told me to start writing your feelings. Huh. Write your feelings. Sometimes that really helps. You know what I'm saying? And I didn't want to, take any drugs or anything like that. So what do you call it? They want to give me something to, calm my nerves and all that. And so those nights, I wrote my feelings, which became 5 days in August.
Yeah, that again. If you're a Yankee fan, you just go read that. It's amazing. It's touching. One of the craziest parts for me was you actually drove. I'm getting chills from this. You drove his car back from Teterboro Airport.
Right.
I mean, none of this can be easy. I assume he was in the end, was he like a brother to you? Is that how you thought of Thurman Munson?
We were brothers. You can't even imagine how close we really were, because it was the aspect, at that time, I was close with his family, with the kids. I would drive them to the airport. They would take off, and I was happy as a pig in shit. Because here's a teenage Puerto Rican with a brand new Cadillac, and I'm saying? That was like the coolest shit. I could pick up all the girls I wanted, and then I'm taking them to an apartment on 79th and 5th. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Come on, man.
I had the
world by the balls, as they would say, and it was just a glorious time. And with Thurman, I go pick him up. And we would drive back. Our talks were so deep, so strong, so funny, and we would bullshit about music and he used to say that I was the corny. He said, you got to be the corniest black or Puerto Rican or whatever the fuck you are. You're weird because you're listening to this pop shit, and Thurman wanted to listen to disco and all that stuff. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I wanted to listen to Donny Osmond. I wanted to, I was bad. I was a pop guy. I was a pop addict. I love that music. I would listen to Wayne Newton, Daddy, Don't You Walk So Fast, and all that. I mean, that's bad. That's horrible. But that's what I liked.
Yeah. Hey, the heart wants what the heart wants.
So we would literally sit at the McDonald's across the street from the Yankee Stadium, and he would buy hamburgers for everybody and stuff. He was just a different kind of bird, man. You know what? And the beauty of Thurman Munson was 1976. He's having a great year, but Mickey Rivers was having a great year. Okay, and Thurman Munson rooted so hard for Rivers. Like, he kept on telling Rivers, I don't want that motherfucking trophy. I don't need another fucking plaque in my fucking house, Rivers. You better win that thing. You better win that fucking thing. And you know what? And literally, when Thurman won the MVP, he was upset for Rivers.
Wow.
He wanted Rivers to win that trophy. You know what I'm saying? Unbelievable. And it was so sincere. It was sick.
He tells some great stories about Thurman Munson in that article, like I said. And you talk about his generosity, just getting, he would get stuff from sponsors and he didn't need it. So he wouldn't give it not just to other players on his team. He would actually have you go give it to other players on opposing teams.
Yes, yes.
Because he knew, like, that they didn't have the equipment that he did, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Again, I emphasize, those days are totally different than today. In those days, players literally went to department stores to buy batting gloves.
Wow.
Some guys went to, to buy shoes and stuff like that. That's how it was.
Wow.
That's nuts.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite Thurman Munson memory or story?
My favorite Thurman Munson story. Well, you know, it's just, we used to watch Soul Train every Saturday in the clubhouse.
Yeah.
You know, in the players' lounge. And he would, you know, when they do the line on Soul Train, and everybody, you know, the line was when people get up and they play like a real fast, hard, black song.
Mm-hmm.
And you would have the people do a line, and they would walk that line doing a dance. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And fucking Thurman Munson could dance his ass off.
Really?
Unbelievable.
Huh.
But we used to love, because we used to start saying, go Thurman, go Thurman, go Thurman, go Thurman. And he, oh, forget about it.
Yeah,
he,
see, that
great.
You couldn't guess. Especially a catcher.
I got a better one for you. We were on the team bus. And remember, in those days, I used to have a nice afro. And so Thurman would be sitting in back of me. I would be sitting with Reggie, and Thurman would be in back of me. And then he would just be fluffing on my hair, just playing with it. How the fuck do you do that? Hey, I mean, some of the hairs in the back are like straight. How'd you get the top to curl up like that and shit? And so I said, Thurman, you could do that shit too. And he would say, get the fuck out of here. You think so? I said, yeah, you can do that. Go to those beauty parlors and shit, I'm telling you. And you know what he did? The next day, he walked into the clubhouse with an afro.
You're the reason why Thurman Munson had an afro.
That's why.
Amazing.
That's exactly why. Imagine.
That's unbelievable. That's unbelievable. You have multiple claims to fame with Thurm. And he just, obviously, he was a great guy. You know, baseball still gives out the Thurman Munson Award for essentially for generosity with people, right?
Well, he was so good with kids, man. You know, he was like very sensitive about kids with mental disability. That bothered the hell out of him, you know, and the kids with what today we call it Down syndrome and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like that.
Yeah.
You know, that bothered the shit out of him.
Part of what you did, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, as the special assistant or whatever we want to call it, you actually would bring, you were in charge of bringing players, or I don't know if you were in charge or you took this upon yourself, you would bring players to, like, children's hospitals.
Yeah, you know, honestly speaking, that was something that I picked up in watching, like, you know, the history of Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, you know, and you watch those, you know, like when you watch the Pride of the Yankees and you see them visiting the kids, it's something that's stuck to my head, and I always said if I ever got the opportunity, I was going to, in essence, always push that.
Yeah.
You know? And then, you know, Reggie did a beautiful thing one day. This poor boy got burnt over 90% of his body, including his face, like you wouldn't believe. And one day Reggie said to me, we're going to this hospital to visit this kid. And when we walked into that room and to see the little boy, it scared me so bad. I mean, I was mortified. But Reggie did the most incredible thing ever. He went and he reached for the little boy without any kind of fear or anything like that. And when I saw him do that, I said for the rest of my life, I will always go and help the less privileged and never be afraid to, in essence, let them know that they are somebody too.
Yeah. That's amazing. And I also read that you were allowed to do it except for during the playoffs. So it's kind of hands off. Like, you can't do that, right?
Right, because they want, you know, that's very emotional stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And George wanted, that was the only time that the boss would say, I want total commitment and concentration. And that's what we did. And so I never asked the player during the playoffs to do anything. But once the season started, you know, fuck that. You know, if I ever had a chance to get a player into a hospital to make a life better for a child or, you know, even an old person, then we're going to do it.
After Thurman, who was the most willing Yankee to do that?
Well, you know what? Reggie was always very good. Reggie was, he was just the most low-key when it came to that, because with him, it was just like he just did it to do it. He just did it. There was nothing. He just felt, you know, like he'd be driving or something, like, oh, let me stop off at this hospital and see this kid a minute. And he would do that, you know? It was like very unassumed, unannounced. No, I never even knew what he was doing. He would just do it. So Reggie was always great. Reggie doesn't ever get the real credit for the aspect of things that he did that were good. But Reggie was good. Mercer was incredible. You know, I'm...
What about like a Jeter? Uh-oh, you got quiet.
let me just say this. Jeter's a nice guy, okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, was he a go-to guy for me?
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Okay, like Alex Rodriguez? Hey, Alex was incredible, okay? There are so many poor kids around Yankee Stadium who never even been inside the damn park. And yet couldn't even join Little League or anything like that. And I would go to Alex Rodriguez, and I would say, Alex, there's probably 100 kids who can't play Little League this year because they just can't, what do you call it? How much money you need, Ray?
Wow.
And you know, I said, give me 10. And he signed a check, and I give it to the league, and they have the kids play.
That's insane. And that's the stuff that's never, ever reported.
Nope, and he did that. Hey, he did that every year he was a Yankee.
Well, I give him a lot of respect for that.
He did that every year that he was a Yankee. I didn't have to go through their foundation. I hate that shit.
Huh.
You go, hey, listen, can we help these kids out? Go to my foundation. But do I have to go through the board and all that
right.
stuff? Well, you know, it's different now. I'm in a different category. I'm like, go fuck yourself.
You just want to check out of their pocketbook, essentially.
Hey, go there. If they need a sandwich, go get them a sandwich.
Right.
Let's stop the shit. You're making $10 million a year. You can't get them a Nathan's.
Ray, I want to be respectful of your time. You've already spent a lot of time with us, so I have a few more questions for you.
Just go ahead. Just
okay.
Roll.
Were you essentially the special assistant until the end with George?
Hey, let me put it to you like this. Yeah, my business card, special assistant to George M. Steinbrenner III. And I promised him that I would never get another card. And to this day, I still keep that card.
Wow.
You know?
Okay, that's but, awesome.
And right up to the end, if I was ever doing anything, I don't give a fuck. I went to him and I told him what I was going to do.
Wow.
I guess that was a part of my denial or whatever. But you know what? He, as far as I'm concerned, he was the man. He was the boss. He was the greatest. He was the guy who, in essence, taught me how to give back. You know, because I used to say, he always used to say to me, you always need to be able to give back. I said, boss, but I don't have anything to give. He's saying, he would always say, yeah, but you have your soul, and that's good enough.
Yeah.
Is that the biggest lesson you took from him?
Absolutely.
That's quite a legacy.
Absolutely. And the whole aspect of being, like, I'm a good person, and I know I'm a good person. And I'm a good person because of my growing up with these men, and I emphasize men, those guys, the Munsons and Reggie and Mercer and Billy Martin, and of course, and unequivocally, George Michael Steinbrenner III. No question. I'm a better person. I'm probably alive today. Listen, my brothers have lived in and out of Rikers Island forever. And my two cousins that were with me that day are both dead now.
Wow.
Okay? So I, as far as I'm concerned, I was allowed to have quality life.
He saved your life,
I'm not a rich man. I don't make that much money working for the Yankees, but it's the only job I really want. You understand?
Yeah.
I love the aspect of what I do. I've been lucky enough to have appeared in 5 movies. I don't know how many commercials. I've gotten to work with Francis Ford Coppola. Okay, I'm very close friends with actors like Richard Gere, Chaz Palminteri, you name it. I produced an animated film for children, okay, called Henry and Me.
Mm-hmm.
And all those guys came to war with me to do it for free so that these kids with cancer could always have a film that they could look at and call their own. That doesn't happen.
No.
That George Steinbrenner's not showing me the right way.
Yeah. So Henry and Me also has, so you said Richard Gere's in there, Bernie Williams, Reggie Jackson, Michael Caine, and John Sterling contribute. I mean, it's Yankee-dom. If you're a Yankee fan, you got to watch Henry and Me, I would assume.
I think if you're any kid in a hospital and you watch Henry and Me, it's gonna mentally give you that charge that, hey, I got to get better so that I can go on.
You've also written a couple or multiple children's books. You wrote The Greatest Story Never Told. You wrote The Boy of Steel, A Baseball Dream Come True. One Last Time, Goodbye to Yankee Stadium. Is that a kid's book or that's not a kid's book?
No, that is a kid's book.
It is. And then you also wrote a book with CeCe Sabathia.
Right.
CeCe Claus, right. A Baseball Christmas Story. How does that happen?
Right. That was a fun book. I would love to make that book into an animated film. I think it would be incredible.
And does CeCe just come to you because he knows that you've done multiple children's books?
What happened was I've known CeCe longer than any of the other Yankees. And, you know, Lisa, you know, he's a big, yeah, chubby, fun-looking. He's a dad of 5 kids. Four kids, and you know, he's the perfect dad, and he's gone through things. And I just went up to him one day, and I said, "Let's do a book together." And I came, you know, basically, you know, we sat down. What would be cool? And I always wanted to do a Christmas story. You know, I mean, you know, only the stars get to do Christmas stories. So I said, "Fuck it, I'm gonna break that thing." And we did a. We did that book, and it was fun, and it's a nice story, you know?
Yeah.
As you see, the boss is in all of my children's books.
And also, you wrote the book Yankee Miracles, Life with the Boss and the Bronx Bombers. So, obviously, he's a big part of that book, too.
You better believe it. You better believe it. And did you read that book?
I have not read that book yet, but I am going to read it.
You have to. You have to. You have to read it. You really do. It really tells you a lot, and it's a beautiful book. It's a beautiful story. And Sally Cook, I did the book with Sally Cook because I wanted a woman. You know, Frankie Valli told me, when I told him I was thinking about doing that book, he said to me, "Do it with a woman." Hmm. And I asked him why. He said, "Because she'll give you that sensitivity that a guy's not going to give you, especially in the sports and entertainment field."
Yeah,
and he was so right. He was so dead on. Because I literally cried all throughout the the writing of that book, and there was so many emotions. I almost killed her, you know?
Oh, no. It's a different reason to cry.
Yeah. But yes, let's mention the name again. Yankee Miracles, Life with the Boss and the Bronx Bombers. I am absolutely going to read that. Okay, one last question for you, Ray. What is, and I know you have to have one, what is your favorite charity?
My favorite charity is Hank's Yanks Baseball.
Tell us about Hank's Yanks.
Hank's Yanks we've had Hank's Yanks for like the last 7 years. And what happened was there was a guy that I grew up with who used to be a drug dealer. And he was calling me after he finally got out of jail and all that kind of stuff. He was calling me and I was saying, shit, man, I don't feel like talking to this guy. And so then I found out that he was calling me because he had seen some players in his neighborhood that actually needed an opportunity to play someplace. But because he had been in and out of jail at the time and this and that, I was saying to myself, well, now what the fuck, man? You know, I got to keep away from that stuff. People, places, things. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I was sitting with the boss one day, and the phone kept ringing and ringing and ringing. And Steinbrenner goes, who the fuck is that? And I said, and I told him who it was. And so then he got pissed at me. And he says, you know, you really got to fucking set a big one. And I said, why are you saying that to me? And he says, do you understand where you came from? You know what I'm saying? And that was, you know, that was a real slap in the face. And he says, suppose I would have said the same thing back then.
Right.
And man, I almost started crying at that point. And then he said, I think you owe this guy a phone call. And so I called the guy up. He told me he had all these kids that wanted to play baseball. So I went to see the kids, and what happened? They were all really good baseball players. They just didn't have money to join leagues and all that kind of stuff. So I went back, reported to Steinbrenner, and he says, well, you know what? Let's help these kids out. And he said, but you know what? Go to Hank, because I'm just too tired to be. I can't do it. You know that. Go to Hank. And so I went to his son, Hank, and I told him about the kids, and he saw the kids, and a love affair started between Hank and these kids, and we started our first team, and that team won a New York City championship, and we got to play a championship game at Yankee Stadium, and they won against a team that was sponsored by Mariano Rivera. It was unbelievable. And we've had over 15 players drafted playing pro ball, and we've had, like, I don't know how many players get scholarships to go on to school and better their lives, you know? So that's my favorite charity. But let me say that pediatric cancer research is huge for me. Huge.
Okay, well, tell me which one's your... out of the two.
We only need one.
Let's go to Hank. Let's do Hank's Yanks. Thurman Munson was number 15, so let us donate $150 to Hank's Yanks on behalf of Ray Negron. Ray, thank you so much for spending this time with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, I appreciate it.
Are you anywhere on social media where people can find you, Ray?
I would have to ask Teresa, because she's the one that runs that. I mean, when, you know, with my books and stuff like that, I'm sure it's out there.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll be in touch. And that way you can give me, if there is any way people can, you know, contact you or like you or whatever, that's what we'll do. And again, $150 to Hank's Yanks. Thank you again, Ray Negron, for joining us today on Failing Up.
Thank you. And it was fun.
Thanks, Ray.